Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us today Kewaskum's high school students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we also have Stockbridge High School students. Would they please stand? Good seeing you too. You may be seated. The students are here with us with a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. It's called Court with Class. Students around the state are invited to come and listen to an oral argument. And if the school accepts the invitation, students are given materials relating to the case, and they may engage in outside activities relating to the case. They then come to the court, listen to the case, and after our second case this morning, the students are invited to join a justice of this court to discuss the proceedings of the court in accepting and deciding cases. Discussion does not relate to the substantive provisions of the case. And today, Justice Crooks will be handling the noon session. And not only are the students invited to come, they will be joined by other students who will come to the next case, but anyone in the audience is welcome to join Justice Crooks in the discussion. If anybody here would like a summary of this case, the marshal will give you one if you raise your hand. Easier to hear and understand the case if you have a basic understanding of the facts and law. Just raise your hand. Thank you, Marshall. While that's being done, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. There is an empty chair next to Justice Gableman. Usually Justice Patience Robinsack sits there, but she is not participating in this case. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. He is the justice with whom you will meet later. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. Just make sure you're in the chair. I'm here. Sometimes I do this by rote, and there's an empty chair sitting there. With those introductions made and the materials distributed, I will call the first case for today, 07AP203, Michael Polsky versus Daniel Vernich. I have the schedule is 25 minutes for Attorney Schott, 25 minutes for Robert Casita, 5 minutes for John Knight of Amicus Curiae, Wisconsin Bankers Association, and 5 minutes in rebuttal for Donald Schott. Before you begin, Mr. Schott, today is the first Wednesday of the month, which has great significance in the Capitol because at 11 o'clock there will be a fire alarm signal. We just stay put. There's no need to evacuate. The problem is it's ear-shattering. And although I warned you all and the court is aware of this, it always comes as a great surprise. So bear that in mind. Nothing personal to any of the people arguing. Mr. Schott.
Chief Justice Abramson, members of the court, I am Don Schott with my partners Jeff Davis and Val Bailey. We are proud to represent Dan Vernick and Jack Moores in this appeal. The Court of Appeals, in the first sentence of its certification order in this case, framed the question as follows: whether officers or directors who are the sole owners of a corporation may manage that corporation for their own benefit at the expense of the corporation and its creditors. Under existing law, the answer to that question is generally yes, but with exceptions. I think the more important follow-up questions are, what are those exceptions? Do any of them apply to the facts of this case under existing Wisconsin law? And should Wisconsin existing law be modified in any way? None of those exceptions under existing Wisconsin law apply here. Wisconsin law should not be modified, and as a result, the judgment here should be vacated and this case dismissed. There are several provisions of Wisconsin law that do restrict the ability of directors who are the sole owners of a corporation in their conduct of the corporation and require them to respect the interests of other constituencies of that corporation, such as employees and creditors. These include statutory provisions like the provision in Chapter 180 that prohibits shareholders from obtaining distributions from the corporation if those distributions would cause the corporation to become insolvent. Those include restrictions that require preferential transfers to be transferred back to the corporation in certain circumstances. And obviously those restrictions include the fiduciary duty to creditors that comes into play when a corporation becomes insolvent and no longer a going concern under Beloit Liquidating Trust. But if none of those restrictions apply, and none of those are implicated, then as Justice Fairchild said in the Western Industries versus Vilter Manufacturing case that we cite at page 14 of our reply brief, a private corporation is free to do what it wants with its assets as long as the shareholders consent.
Can I just interrupt you for a moment? Is it your opinion that the directors, officers, sole shareholders have any fiduciary duty to the corporation as such? Yes or no?
Yes, to the corporation, but you have to define the corporation as what are the interests of the corporation. The corporation is not...
Go ahead.
The corporation has a number of constituencies, but I think the problem...
Is the corporation itself a constituency?
No. The corporation...
You say the corporation is not a constituency. As I read your brief, you mush together the corporation and the sole shareholders. They are one and the same. And it seems to me that is a basic violation of corporate law, because the whole point of corporate law is to protect the shareholders from individual liability and say you have two entities here, the shareholders and the corporation. And the corporation can do business as such, and everybody should look to the corporation. And you say, oh, no, they're one and the same, no separate entity. That's how I read your brief. That's your answer to my question. Is there a duty to a corporation? You say yes, but you don't really mean it.
I do mean it, Your Honor, but in this section,
glad to hear you say that.
You have to look at the constituencies that are affected. Let me give you an example. Let's say in 1999, which is a year that Communication Products Corporation had a profit. At the end of that year, Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores decided that they were just tired of being in the loudspeaker business. And so they decided to close the business down. They paid off all the debts of the corporation. They filed the papers for winding down the corporation. And they ended the corporation's life. What, you know, that's the ultimate example of putting their interests ahead or at the expense of the corporation. They killed the corporation. They ended.
According to law.
According to law, exactly. And the law allows that, and the law allows that because the constituencies of that corporation have all had their interests protected. They followed the law, they paid the debts of the corporation, they have followed the law with respect to winding up the affairs of the corporation. They followed the law. The constituencies have been protected. They don't have a duty to the corporation to have it keep in business ad infinitum, because it is some type of separate entity that has its own interests that are separate and apart from its various constituencies. The interests are the interests of the constituencies. And what we have here quite clearly is a case where the interested constituency is the creditors, and in particular the bank that is the one that sought the appointment of a receiver here and is funding this litigation.
The interest of the receiver who represents the corporation?
Let me go back to my example of 1999. In 1999, Communications Product Corporation paid all of its employees, paid all of its creditors, all of its suppliers, made all the payments to Mr. Burnick and Mr. Moore that the receiver is now attacking, and had a profit. The receiver says he's stepping into the shoes of the corporation to bring claims that the corporation would have at that time. Ask yourself, in 1999, what claim did the corporation have against Mr. Burnick and Mr. Moore's? Who could bring that claim, and what damage would they allege? Every employee was paid, every creditor was paid, all the constituencies, there were no individual shareholders that would say they were treated unfairly compared to other shareholders. All the shareholder payments were ratified by all the shareholders. So there's no constituency of the corporation that had a claim. The receiver's argument here is, well, if the payments to Mr. Burnick and Mr. Morris hadn't been as high as they were, the corporation's profit would have been even greater, and then maybe 5 years later, there would be more money to pay creditors.
Why? What happened after 1999?
After 1999, the corporation continued in business, continued to pay its creditors. It got down to June of 2003. In June of 2003, it had 5 loans outstanding to American Trust and Savings Bank. 4 of those loans were completely current in all principal and interest payments. There was one $100,000 loan that was due at the end of their fiscal year, May 31st, and the bank and the owners of the corporation were negotiating over repayment of that loan. Mr. Burnick and Mr. Morris offered to pay that loan back, but they were asking for certain conditions from the bank. The bank chose to go into court ex parte and obtain a receiver. We proffered evidence at trial that Judge Kirschman ruled was inadmissible and irrelevant, that the only time that the corporation sustained any damage in the sense it was unable to pay its bills is by the act of the bank appointing the receiver. And we had a banking expert who was prepared to testify that the bank's actions violated regular banking standards. And it was the actions of the bank in appointing the receiver that caused any loss that occurred here to creditors.
Receiver was appointed.
The receiver was appointed.
You didn't appeal that.
The corporation has not appealed that.
And you haven't briefed the issue of whether the receiver was validly appointed.
That was briefed in the Court of Appeals. It was not in the Supreme Court.
Not briefed here. Okay. So for at least our immediate purposes, the receiver looks okay. You haven't briefed that it isn't.
My point was this, Your Honor. You asked what happened to the corporation.
Okay.
And that is what we believe happened to
it
the corporation.
It didn't go out of business in 1999.
It did not. But the damages that have been assessed against Mr. Burnick and Mr. Moore include the payments that were made to them in 1999. There is no nexus. There's no causal connection. 1999, not only, as I mentioned, is a year where the corporation made a profit, that was a year, that fiscal year, I'm talking about the fiscal year of 1999, which actually started in June of 1998 and went through May 31st of 1999. That is before the American Trust and Savings Bank even became a creditor of CPC.
So it continued in business and it kept borrowing, right?
Yes, and paying its debts.
Right. But it had some problems paying debts.
I'm sorry, I didn't
hear. It had some problems paying debts timely and in accordance with your agreements.
It had a $100,000 loan that came due on May 31st of 2003 that Mr. Vernick and Mr. Morris offered to repay, but they were asking the bank primarily to either waive any claim against them personally or at least tell them what claim the bank thought it had against them personally so they could carve it out of any agreement.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Schott, did the corporation have a lot of loans out in 1999?
It did have loans out. I'm not sure of the amount, but I do know that all of the loans that it had out were being paid on a current basis. They had two manufacturing facilities. There were real estate loans and mortgages with respect to the real estate locations, and there was also an operating line of credit.
Mr. Schott, one of the concerns that I have is that as I read your pleading, you rely very heavily on Beloit Liquidating Trust. And Beloit Liquidating Trust seems to me a very different case from this case for several reasons. But one of the main reasons is in Beloit you had an action being brought by creditors. Here you have a situation where the receiver is bringing the action. And your opposing counsel cites to a Seventh Circuit case that seems to be very close to this case in terms of facts, the Scholes versus Lehman case. And in that case, the Seventh Circuit makes a major point of the receiver and how the receiver stands in the shoes of the corporation. Can you tell me how you get around the Scholes case and why you think Beloit rather than Scholes is the applicable case we should be looking at?
Yes. The receiver does stand in the shoes of the corporation, which brings me back to my point. What claim did the corporation have? How can the corporation claim it was damaged by a lease payment that was made in 1999 that did not affect the corporation's ability to pay its ongoing obligations and to pay its creditors? The corporation had no such claim. If there's any harm that can be alleged here, it's a harm by a creditor that is trying to bring a claim, and that's exactly the Beloit situation. What we have here is a creditor who does not have a claim that it can make under the existing existing Wisconsin law. It can't meet the tests of Beloit. It can't meet the tests of Chapter 180. And so it is sought to do an end run around Beloit by appointing a receiver and having the receiver bring this claim, quote unquote, on behalf of the corporation. But again, you have to ask yourself, how is the corporation damaged by this action in 1999 or in 2000 or in 2001 or in 2002?
How much money did the defendants take out of the corporation after 1999?
I don't know that exact number.
From the ballpark.
After 1999, I would say probably about $3
million. $3 million. Okay. That reduced the corporation's assets by $3 million.
Correct.
If the corporation is a separate entity from the shareholders, the corporation has an interest in whether that $3 million was taken out according to the corporate laws, doesn't it?
If the corporation has a separate interest, then it has such an interest.
And we go back to the point, you won't recognize the corporation as a separate entity from the shareholders. You are piercing the corporate veil and insisting on it being pierced. That is a radical, radical legal proposition.
Perhaps we're not communicating well here, and I'm sure it's my fault, and I apologize for that. The corporation is a separate entity, but when you determine it's a separate entity, you have to also ask, what are its interests here?
The interests are having high assets. That's what its interests are.
Well, it also has an interest. Why is this corporation in existence? It's in existence to make money for its shareholders.
Ah, but it is in existence for other purposes, too. Pay its bills.
Yes. And to the extent that that interest is protected under Wisconsin law, it is protected by things like the provisions of Chapter 180, like the fiduciary duty that arises to creditors when the corporation becomes insolvent or no longer a going concern. All those interests are protected, but there's not, it's not a fiduciary duty to the creditors, and that's...
Fiduciary duty to the corporation. You're not willing to recognize that, are you?
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be evasive. Yes, there's a fiduciary duty to the corporation, but what is the interest of the corporation? Let me take another example.
Mr. Schott, if I could interject, and I think I understand what the chief is asking, and it's similar to a question that I have. Sometimes shareholders decide, even in a profitable business, they're ready to be done, and they decide to dissolve a corporation and go out of business. And they receive, you know, the assets, or they do whatever they need to do to finally close down the business and dissolve it. Why isn't that a breach of fiduciary duty to the corporation? Every time someone closes down a corporation.
If the corporation has a separate interest as well as being a separate entity, then arguably that is a breach of fiduciary duty to the corporation.
Well, doesn't the law allow dissolution?
The law allows that. The law allows distributions to shareholders except when it makes the corporation insolvent under Chapter 180. Yes, the law...
There are other reasons that you don't have distributions to shareholders, not only insolvency.
Well, another example that comes up very frequently, corporations pay dividends to shareholders. That takes money out of the corporation and gives it to the shareholder.
Then they're lawful.
Yes, when they are lawful. And here, in 1999, if Mr. Burnick and Mr. Moores had paid themselves a dividend instead of a lease payment of a certain amount, I mean, in essence, what the receiver's theory is these some of these payments were disguised dividends, that they were paying more for the equipment than they were worth, that the management fee was more than for the services rendered, so it, in essence, it's a disguised dividend. Well, let's call it a dividend. In 1999, they could have paid themselves exactly the amount of money that they did pay themselves as a dividend, and would that be a breach of fiduciary duty to the corporation?
No, but maybe to the U.S. government on tax issues.
Exactly.
Because they took it as an expense, and a dividend can't be taken as an expense.
And they had accountants that helped them file their tax returns. Their tax returns were filed. They were audited once by the state of Wisconsin. And if any taxing authority had felt that any of these transactions violated the tax laws, then actions could be taken against Mr. Burnick and Mr. Moores as a result of that. Absolutely. And there's no evidence that that ever occurred here.
Could I ask a question? When was this company acquired?
Mr. Burnick and Mr. Moores acquired it in 1986.
How much did they pay for it?
I don't recall exactly. They lent money. They put some money in. They lent money. They purchased the equipment personally and then leased the equipment to the corporation. And so they had an investment. It's in the record. I don't know exactly what that number is. It was a substantial investment.
So the company was acquired in 1986. What is the special significance of 1999?
I use 1999 only as an example, in part because that was the year before the bank here even became a creditor. But other than that, there's no special significance. Justice Abramson asked me the question earlier with respect to the amount of money that Mr. Burnick and Mr. Moores took out of the corporation over a certain period of time. When you look at the entire period of time for which we have financial statements, the financial information from 86 to 1990 is just gone. But from 1990 to the time the receiver was appointed in 2003, the corporation made over $12 million. And Mr. Burnick and Mr. Moores, there's some dispute in the record as to how much they took out. The receiver says $10.5 million. We say it was a little less than that. But in any event, what they took out was less than the corporation made. It was less than the profits of the corporation. So they ran this corporation for 17 years. I think the receiver in his argument will show you some statistical information from an exhibit that was put up, and you'll see that in most of those years, the corporation made a profit. It sold loudspeakers mainly to the automobile industry, so it's a bit of a cyclical business because of the cyclical nature of the automobile industry, but the corporation made money. Mr. Burnick and Mr. Moores, as the owners of that corporation, profited from that, but they also reinvested money into the community. They expanded. They paid workers. They paid salaries. They protected the other constituencies, and now you have a constituency, a bank, that didn't protect itself through getting a personal guarantee, now attempting to do an end run around Beloit by coming in and making a claim that Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores violated a duty to the corporation, but they're not articulating what the interest of the corporation is, other than if it has some interest in perpetually being in business and not being for the benefit of its shareholders.
Mr. Schott, I know that your time is getting short, and one of the issues that I thought was very interesting here was the issue of the statute of limitations and the question of whether or not the discovery rule should be applied. Now, I understand the reasoning of the circuit court judge was basically that until the receiver was appointed, that the receiver had no opportunity to see what had been going on in terms of the transfer of funds to your clients, and therefore the discovery rule should apply from the date of the appointment of the receiver. How do you respond to that?
Number one, I think you rejected application of the discovery rule in Beloit. Number two, clearly the corporation, if the receiver is standing in the shoes of the corporation had full knowledge of all these transfers. And number three, I respond by looking at the inequity that is encompassed in that. In late 1999, the most significant creditor here, the bank, made a decision to extend credit to Communications Products Corporation. When it made that decision, it knew all about the equipment leasing trust. It knew all about the payments that had already been paid to Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores. It knew all about what equipment was there to support those lease payments. It made a decision. And yet now it is trying to, through the guise of the receiver and application of both a discovery rule and an adverse domination rule, go back and say, we want to get paid the money that's owed us out of money that was paid to Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores in 1992, 1994, 1996, 1998, 1999, all the way through, going back and picking up all those payments, going back ad infinitum. That would be like if Ford goes into bankruptcy, somebody trying to go back and get Henry Ford's original salary on the idea that he was paid too much when he invented the Model T back in 1908 or whenever it was.
Isn't it true that there were parent corporations here and that the bank, for instance, didn't have the availability of looking at audits in regard to those two parent corporations, and therefore there was no understanding of what was being transferred back and forth? I understood one of the allegations had to do with a so-called loan of $500,000. That it's alleged was not a loan. The bank didn't have access to that kind of information until after appointment of the receiver, isn't that right?
No, that is not right. The bank had full knowledge of the $500,000 dividend shortly after it was made, and so factually that's just not correct. But beyond that,
wasn't it shown on the books of CBC as being a loan that allegedly wasn't a loan?
No. What was shown on the books, Basic Products Corporation, the immediate parent, owed money to Communications Products Corporation. At one point, it owed over $1 million to Communications Products Corporation. A bookkeeping entry was made to reduce the amount of that debt by $500,000. And that was explained in the bookkeeping as a dividend, a non-cash dividend, simply a bookkeeping entry, reducing the debt that Basic owed to Communication Products Corporation. That was put in the year-end financial statements by the auditors that occurred at the year-end of 2002. The bank was aware of it when they received the audited financial statements of CPC shortly after the fiscal year ended, July or August of 2002, knew about it at that time. The other point I would make, though, Justice Crooks, in response to that, if the bank has a claim that Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores lied to it, defrauded them in some ways, they could bring that claim. They chose not to bring that claim, I think because they didn't have factual support for it, and that's why they do the end run around Boyd grading and these other restrictions. That's why they're trying to step into the shoes of the receiver. If Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores defrauded the bank, lied to the bank, told the bank things that weren't true, failed to disclose things they were obligated to disclose, they could be sued by the bank. But that is not the case here, which is another reason why the various constituencies, including creditors, have been protected here. I see my red light is on.
I have a question for you, though. Is it your position that a receiver of a corporation can never bring an action to collect assets of a corporation for waste, mismanagement, whatever you want to call it? Because the receiver is a creditor, represents creditors, and therefore no cause of action under Beloit, is that, and the giver?
No, the receiver steps into the shoes of the corporation. Right. It could bring any claim that the corporation had.
Okay.
My position is here, the corporation had no claim.
No claim against the shareholders.
No claim against the shareholders.
Why not?
A, all these transactions were ratified.
Okay.
B, they did not affect any of the, they did not implicate any of the restrictions against directors and officers' abilities to control the corporation that are set forth in Beloit, the various statutory protections we've talked about. And there is no fiduciary duty to the corporation that is above and beyond the fiduciary duty to the various constituencies of the corporation.
No fiduciary duty to corporation above and beyond duty to shareholders.
The various constituencies is what I intended.
Okay, and various constituents includes creditors?
Yes.
Okay.
And that is protected through Beloit and through the statutory provisions.
But only Beloit?
And the statutory provisions.
And statutory provisions. Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Schott, I'm not going to ask you this now, but I suspect your opposing counsel is going to make a point about punitive damages. We'll want to hear, at least I will want to hear about that in your rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Schott, two very brief questions. The first is, prior to June of 2003, was the income of the corporation insufficient to meet any of its outside obligations to any interested party? Besides discounting the issue of the $100,000 loan?
It was an ongoing business. The receiver testified it was an ongoing business. As with any ongoing business, there were times when there were some slow pays to creditors, but it was ongoing functioning business. All the employees were being paid.
But at some point, the income from the corporation was used to satisfy those obligations, ?
Yes, if I understand your question.
Well, at some point, no matter whether it was directly on time or at some point later, what was income from the corporation sufficient to meet those obligations prior to June of 2003?
Yes, and
I promise they'd be quick, and the red light's been on for some time. And the second part of that question is, since June 2003, has the income from the corporation been sufficient to meet the obligations of the corporation to the outside interested parties?
After the receiver took possession of the corporation, he sold all the assets of the majority of the assets of the corporation, the working assets of the corporation, to a group of employees, and that business is continuing to operate, but it's now owned by a different group of people. The assets are now owned by
the obligations of the corporation have been satisfied.
The obligations of CPC have not been completely satisfied. There is money owed to the bank, and there is money owed to unsecured creditors. It's about $600,000 to unsecured creditors, and I think the amount to the bank is about $1 million, and that, which includes the money they've spent funding this litigation.
So liabilities exceeded assets?
As a result of the actions the receiver took, yes.
Before that, liabilities were less than assets? Is that your position?
Yes, that there was no insolvency prior to June of 2003.
What's the definition of insolvency?
The net worth on a going concern basis of the assets compared to the liabilities, current liabilities.
Was that ever determined by court?
On an ex parte basis, yes.
And what did the court determine?
The court determined, without hearing any evidence or information from my clients, that there was an insolvency justifying the appointment of a receiver.
Assets were less than liabilities.
On a liquidation basis.
You didn't appeal that.
the receiver is not, the time for appealing the receivership has not expired because the receivership is still ongoing.
I know, but you didn't appeal, and you entered into a stipulation on this issue.
I represent Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores. Mm-hmm. The receivership was against CPC. Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores were not parties to that.
Corporation didn't.
The corporation did not.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You still have 5 minutes left.
Thank you.
Mr. Casita, represent the receiver, Mr. Polsky. Who are you really, the receiver, or are you the bank?
Thank you.
Really?
I am Bob Cachetta, and
indeed.
Drew Parrish, Your Honor, we tried this case.
Mm-hmm.
May it please the court. I am here on behalf of Michael Polsky. Michael Polsky is the duly appointed Chapter 128 receiver. I am not here on behalf of American Trust. I'm not here on behalf of any other creditor, secured or unsecured. And what Vernick and Moores would have this honorable court believe is that Chapter 128 doesn't have any real meaning. That the essence of Chapter 128 is that the receiver stands in the shoes of the creditors. Effectively, by legislative fiat, reversing the holding of Beloit Liquidating Trust, which says, of course, that there is no obligation to the creditors unless or until the company is no longer going in concern or is insolvent. Well, unless or until there's insolvency, the receiver would not be appointed. And therefore, the argument of Vernick and Moores essentially denudes Chapter 128 of any realistic meaning. So to be clear, I am not here for any of the creditors. One of the questions that came up during the course of counsel's argument, and counsel himself asked it, probably bears some consideration, and that is, what is the interest of the corporation? How is that articulated? And that interest is anchored in Chapter 180, anchored in the legislative history of corporate law in this state, as modified by the Model Act in 1989. It is anchored in the common law notions of breach of fiduciary duty that this court has long recognized. We cited it in Gauger, we cited it in the other cases leading up to and including Beloit Liquidating Trust, which Justice Crooks is right, did not take the position that there was no obligation to the corporation, but only dealt with the issue of obligations to creditors prior to the onset of insolvency. So then what is that interest that is owed to the corporation? The interest goes back as far as 1950s when Justice Benjamin Cardozo talked about the breach of fiduciary duty as the highest duty known to individuals, known to mankind. The duty owed to this corporation is to put the interests of the corporation ahead of the self-dealing interests of these directors. Now, I think the court properly points out that there is a lot of uncertainty or indefinite quality to the arguments of Vernick and Moores, talking about directors and shareholders as if they were interchangeable, but they are not. Chapter 180 specifically references the obligations of shareholders and the obligations of directors, and 180 prohibits and makes voidable, as a matter of law under 0831, self-dealing contracts or relationships established by directors. And it does not conscience the kind of conduct that occurred here. And with the court's permission, I would like to distribute and have given to the marshal exhibit number 73 at trial, which was used and will help us to discuss, hopefully, the nature of the conduct that Vernick and Moores engaged in.
But their position, thank you, and have you seen what counsel is going to present?
Yes, I have.
Do you have any objection? Okay. Mr. Cachetta, what about, I'll go along with 180.0831, breach of duty of the corporation by the directors. thought the council said, hey, the law is if the shareholders have given full information and they accept it, they own the company, and if they're willing to go along with a conflict with the directors, so be it. Nobody, that's okay. How do you answer that?
The law does not support that position, Your Honor, because the corporation is a vital legal person. The Gauger case stands for it. Every case in which the court has taken up that issue has recognized, as does Chapter 180, that the corporation is an independent, separate stakeholder, that the corporation's interests cannot be ignored. And where a director decides that it will take steps and act in its own self-interest, his or her own self-interest, to the detriment of the corporation, it is then when liability attaches.
Well, what's the action that you're complaining about?
It's multiple, Your Honor. We begin with the notion that Mr. Brennick and Mr. Moores were...
Are they directors?
The directors, yes, Your Honor, were refined businessmen. Mr. Brennick testified that he was a tax accountant with Arthur Anderson for a time. He was also an attorney. And in 1986, when Mr. Brennick and Mr. Moores acquired CPC, they did so by virtue of a complicated transaction. They put in answer the justice process question, $150,000 of their own money. And they guaranteed some additional amounts, but it was in essence a leveraged buyout with a purchase price of $1.7 million. They only put in the entirety of the time that they were involved as capital infusion into CPC, they only put in $150,000 and reaped benefits which we respectfully submit totaled, according to the evidence this jury heard, $12.5 million as their return on the investment of $150,000 cash. All of the rest of the cash that went into CPC ended up being treated as a loan, for which over the course of time they received approximately $250,000 in interest, so that what would otherwise have been and were represented at times to be capital infusions into the corporation actually increased the debt load of the corporation. These were smart people. So what I'd like to do, with the court's permission, is call your attention to Exhibit Number 73, which was, just to put it in perspective, a document which was received at the trial court. The handwriting that you see on Exhibit 73 is a representation of what the handwriting was that the expert for the receiver, Amy Seibel, who is herself an attorney and CPA, placed on this exhibit at trial. The blow-up, which is here, was the actual Exhibit 73 at the trial. And the reason for the handwriting in these columns is because during the course of discovery, we were not entirely aware of all of the extractions. But with the court's forbearance, I'll go through some of these extractions.
Counsel, before you get there,
yes,
help me answer the question that I asked Mr. Schott, too. Why isn't it a breach to the corporation every time someone decides they are done doing business, they want to close up shop, they're going to dissolve their corporation and be done? Even if it's an ongoing concern, it's a great corporation, it might be profitable, but they're done. They don't have children that want to take it over, they want to wrap it up, they want to be done. Why isn't that a breach to the corporation under your theory?
Thank you, Your Honor. Two reasons. One is that the question presumes, I'm assuming, perhaps wrongly, that it does not leave creditors without payment. It presumes that the dissolution of the corporation is done consistent with the corporate law, Chapter 180, which does provide for dissolution or wind-up of the corporate interest. Where it creates a problem, and this is the second prong of the answer, is where there is a breach of the fiduciary duty to the corporation itself because the conduct is essentially unfair. The jury instruction and the law regarding breaches of fiduciary duties has consistently turned upon fairness. And this jury, in fact, was instructed that if the conduct was unfair, now, if
that's,
I may...
That's what I need some help with.
Yes.
Isn't it unfair to kill the corporation? I mean, you know, shouldn't you keep it going forever if you could? That's the difference. We don't want a case that says you can never wind up a corporation.
Absolutely.
Right?
And the receiver, Your Honor, is not asking that this court articulate a common law rule that overturns the legislative proclamation regarding means by which corporations can be dissolved. I understand the court's question. Why doesn't a corporation have a right to live forever, is the question, it seems. Well, the reason a corporation doesn't have a right to live forever is that the same legislature, in contemplation of the fiduciary duties involved, the stakeholders involved, has declared that using the proper procedures, a corporation can be terminated.
Do you agree or disagree with Mr. Schott's representation that there's about 600,000 due to unsecured creditors and about 1 million due to the bank at this point?
I do not disagree with that, although it does not take into account fully the interest that has been accumulating on those obligations. But in a general term, yeah, that's the amount.
So if a creditor is paid off, or if the creditor isn't paid off, why isn't that the damage instead of a breach of fiduciary duty to the corporation? That's what I'm trying to sort out. Why isn't it the obligation to pay off your debts, and if you want to go out of business, go out of business?
And, Your Honor, if the legislature had decided that that was, in fact, the law, it could have been. But that is not what the legislature has said. The legislature has recognized, as has this court in previous decisions, that the corporation has interests of its own, and that the only interests at issue are not those of creditors. They are only one of the stakeholders, and in fact, this court has been favored with a brief by the union, which in part came as an amicus, it appears, from their submission, because Vernick and Morris did not honor the obligations to that stakeholder either by breaching contracts. There was testimony before this jury that the bonuses that were contractually obligated to be paid had to be litigated because Vernick and Morris, as directors and controllers of the corporation, did not honor those obligations either. So if we were talking about creating a rule, which, again, the receiver is not arguing for, which recognized rights in advance of those recognized by Beloit Liquidating Trust to honor obligations to creditors before insolvency, then that rule would also have to take into account other stakeholders. And the legislature, matched to the common law articulated by this court, has come up with a far simpler solution. And that solution is that with regard to creditors, Beloit Liquidating Trust makes it clear there is no direct obligation to creditors until the company ceases to be a going concern and is insolvent. And the legislature has empowered the receiver under 128.19 to stand in the shoes of the corporation, recognizing implicitly that the corporation has rights, and to assert those claims on behalf of the corporation. But that's not where it ends. After those claims have been properly asserted, the rights of creditors are recognized in the distribution section of Chapter 128, which provides a hierarchy of interests which will be recognized, including creditors, and predominantly creditors, so that at that time, at the end of the receivership process, affording these directors significant protection, the rights of the creditors will, in fact, be recognized.
You talked about acquisition in 1986. Mr. Schott talked about 1999. We want to get to your chart. Maybe you could relate your chart to 1999 and explain what's your rebuttal to what he said.
Yes, Your Honor, I can. And in our initial submission to the court at pages 6 and 7, we did distill from the information provided to this jury with reference to the record those issues that relate to the financial well-being of this corporation from 1999 until June 2003 when it went into receivership. And what that shows is that Vernick and Morris were overstating the net worth of the corporation substantially. And in part they were doing that, it is clear, because they were trying to comply with a net worth covenant which mandated on the part of the bank, in its attempt to protect itself, that they would maintain the asset value exclusive of the intercompany receivable account at a certain level. And they, Vernick and Morris, by virtue of this pyramid that they constructed in 1986 when they acquired the company, effectively were able to over-report the net worth of the company. And this was the testimony of the expert for the receiver, Attorney Seibel, Accountant Seibel. And they then, if we look at pages 6 and 7, they were reporting, for example, in 1999, the material year, a net worth of 2.166. It was actually 2.3. Modest difference there. But as it goes on, the reported net worth of CPC is different than the actual net worth. At page 7, we address that issue further, Your Honor, breaking down the income and the reported income of CPC. And the reason for this disparity is because Wernick and Morris decided that when they would structure this arrangement, this pyramid, in 1986, they would create a multi-layered structure. CPC was the entity doing business. It was providing speaker cones to markets, domestic and international. CPC was owned entirely. That is, the stock of CPC was owned by BASIC. Wernick and Morris were not shareholders of CPC, contrary to their multiple assertions. BASIC was the shareholder of CPC. Wernick and Morris created BASIC, and it did no business other than holding the stock of CPC. And they created this complex arrangement by which they had an intercompany receivable account with BASIC, which could be used to increase or decrease the financial viability of this company, depending upon how they wanted to represent the company. In addition to that, above BASIC was CPRO, another shell, which only was involved in the business of holding the stock of BASIC. Above that was a company called Verdanco, which is a sort of the inverse of Dan Wernick, which was his personal holding company, and that branched on the other side to the Jack Morris Voting Trust. The interests of Mr. Morris had been assigned for voting purposes to Mr. Wernick, who effectively controlled the fate of CPC through this Byzantine organization of corporate structures for purposes of hiding from the government, from the bank, from the creditors, and we respectfully submit from CPC itself what was going on.
Now, but all of these structures are legal.
These structures are technically legal, Your Honor. What they did with them
legal
was not.
Legal is legal, not technically.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Legal is legal. But what they did with these structures
that's
is what they're
saying. That's a different issue. And that's
not
your problem. That's what you've got to prove. What,
yes,
this, what does this mean?
Thank you, Your Honor. Exhibit 73 is a distillation from those multiple corporate structures to try to figure out what the worth, the actual value, the numbers were that these directors were paying themselves, the self-dealing. It's an attempt to measure that self-dealing with a realization that there was this corporate structure that was exceedingly difficult to understand. One of the auditors himself testified that at the end of the day, he didn't entirely understand it. Now, I want to make a point and then talk about the columns here. The point is, the defense has consistently argued, whenever we talk about Exhibit 73, that this is an attempt to blur the identity of CPC by looking at its parent and grandparent structures to make some determinations regarding value. That is not the case. CPC has rights that are recognized under Chapter 180, and the attempt to look at the actual value of transactions doesn't undermine the capacity of CPC to be an individual legal person. So with that in mind,
let me interrupt you if I might at this point. When did all of this information that's in Exhibit 73 become available?
Yeah,
because that, for me at least, relates directly to the statute of limitations issue and the discovery issue.
Yes, Your Honor. It became available after the receiver was appointed and in the context of his work to try to determine what was going on. He then presented to Judge Vandehey, the receivership judge, a request that I be hired, and before me, Mr. Basting, Attorney Tom Basting, be hired to represent the receiver in pursuing claims against the director. This information contained in Exhibit 73 did not become clear until well into that subsequent litigation before Judge Kirchman from Crawford County, who by virtue of the substitution of the defendants was brought in to hear the case. So that information was not clear. And I do want to get to Exhibit 73, but I want to address further, Justice Crooks, your question as well regarding this issue of the discovery rule. We are not quarreling with the notion that Chapter 893.57 does apply as a statute of limitation here.
2 years.
The 2-year statute of limitations tempered by Hansen versus A.H. Robbins. And the reason for that discovery rule is, as implied by the court's decision, that the issue of discovery has to be assessed. If Wernick and Moore's position is correct regarding discovery, the knowledge of the thief is imputed to the victim whenever there is an agency relationship that exists between the thief and and the victim. If, in fact, Derek and Moores wrongfully took this money, and the jury has already said that they took $6.5 million that didn't belong to them, if that is so, Derek and Moores argue because the corporation, a separate legal person, was their principal to which they owed the fiduciary duty, it had to know. And therefore, the statute of limitations had to run from the point that they wrongfully took the money because the corporation would be deemed to have to know. Now, there's no reason for not extending that, if that is truly the common law of the state of Wisconsin, to every circumstance in which an agent steals from a principal. Because in every one of those circumstances, there will be the presumption that knowledge to the agent is knowledge to the principal. Moreover, when you look at the reason for Hansen, it makes sense in a circumstance like this, where Wernick and Moores could have resolved this problem. They could have resolved in its entirety this problem by merely including an independent director who did not self-deal.
They didn't do that.
They did not do that.
All right, so when did the statute of limitations start to run?
The statute of limitations, we submit, began to run when the receiver was appointed and could reasonably know, using the language of Hansen, about the existence of a claim. When CPC could know.
What date?
The appointment of the receiver was in June of 2003.
And when could they reasonably know?
Well, we filed within 2 years of the receiver being appointed, so we were conscious of the fact that the statute of limitations was an issue. And somewhere in that first year, when Mr. Polsky went to the court and said, we want permission, leave of the court, to bring the claim against the directors, he had to have a good faith belief that there was a claim. And I would respectfully submit that it was only then that the statute of limitations could really begin to run, at the point where he could, in the shoes of CPC, know.
When did you file this claim?
In May of 2005, my recollection is, Your Honor.
So you're within the 2 years of the appointment, so we don't have to fuss about when you really knew.
I believe that's true, yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Were there any other corporate officers or directors other than the named defendants?
There were no other corporate directors, and in fact, there's a split in the record regarding who, in fact, was a director, because at some point, Mr. Wernick tried to assert that he was the only director. But the corporate documents show that Wernick and Moores were both directors. And in fact, they drew director's fees of approximately over $700,000, as I recall it, or near $1 million, which they say they received in equal part. So there were only these two directors, and they were responsible for making the decisions which were the subject of the breach of fiduciary duty and corporate waste case.
No other officers.
There was an officer, Brian Schultz, who was involved in the day-to-day operation of the corporation, but not involved in the decisions in which bonuses were awarded, in which these equipment leasing trusts were either issued or renewed, in which the money was wrongfully taken out.
Brian Schultz, no?
He said he did not. He said he was quite astounded. In fact, his testimony at trial, he testified as the first witness. Mr. Schultz testified that he didn't know all of the ways in which the money was even going out of the corporation. What he knew as the president of the corporation was that this corporation was struggling. In fact, there was an account that he related in which they didn't even have $100 to do a test to try to fix a problem with a speaker cone because so much money had been taken out at a very time when Wernick and Moores are taking millions out of the company. So he did not know.
He did not know, but couldn't he reasonably know if he couldn't pay for a $100 test?
Well, he is not the corporation, Your Honor. The corporation has a separate right. And he knew that there was a cash shortage. Mr. Wernick testified, even at trial, that the reason for the cash shortage was not the multiple extractions that they took, but the reason for the cash shortage was international competition, downturns in the economy. He had other explanations that he asserted. If I may please, just briefly regarding, because the yellow light's already on, regarding Exhibit 73. This lists the various extractions that Wernick and Moores took out. Salary from CPC. They were never employees of CPC. They took out over the course of these years, and we only go back to 1990 because that's all the data that was available, $875,000 in salaries from CPC. They were never employees of CPC. They paid a salary to Basic, a company which by their own admission didn't do any business. Salaries from BASIC. They drew salaries from BASIC. That's how the money went, as Attorney Seibel testified at trial, up and out. Expense equipment leases. These were devices by which Wernick and Morris would buy equipment which was necessary to the operation of CPC and lease it to the company at exorbitant rates. Testimony in the record was that 10% was a fair valuation, a fair interest rate. They charged 18%. They point to their honor, to the corporation, by saying, well, we at the end, when the cash got really short, we extended those leases. We didn't accept lease payments. But they extended the leases and attached a penalty and extracted from the corporation a valuable license agreement in exchange for that largesse. In addition to that, there are these director's fees. A couple, three meetings a year, they took almost $1 million over the course of time on that. $43,000, $48,000 a year. Dividends. The issue of dividends is very significant because a question was raised in counsel's argument about the issue of dividends. That $500,000 of dividends is still a mystery. Wernick said it was not a cash transaction. It was merely a bookkeeping, and you heard it again this morning, a bookkeeping issue. The fact of the matter is they reported to the federal government that $500,000 was a cash transaction. If I might be permitted to briefly conclude, Your Honor?
Nay.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Consulting fees, they added those in. These were between Wernick and Morris themselves and approved and ratified by them. The management bonuses, in years which are reflected on Exhibit 6 and 7, as years where this company was not doing terribly well, they were extracting bonuses for themselves. In addition to that, there's interest on shareholder debt, which is a reflection, again, of this money that they charged to the company for an influx of capital. Self-dealing. Self-dealing to the nth degree. And let me just, Your Honor.
Did I understand you to say that a salary was paid to BASIC?
That's right, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that be part of the $2,391,000 in the next column?
No, that was a separate salary. That was called out by Attorney Seibel as a separate salary.
These are salaries to these two men.
They're correct. Yes, that's right. The initial ones are salaries to them.
Say that again.
I'm sorry. They both were salaries to these two men. One salary from one corporation, another salary from another corporation. Am I right?
You are correct, Your Honor. Thank you. Yes. By way of very rapid conclusion, what Wernick and Morris are asking this honorable court to do, in an age stretching back to Enron and WorldCom, and as most recently as Bernie Madoff, they're asking this honorable court to say that in Wisconsin, corporate looting is legal. That's what they're asking.
You've got a problem. You know, when you say it that way, man, I get very excited. I'm not polluting, right? I'm not polluting of any kind, right? I mean, I can't be. Shouldn't be. But these guys, smart. I mean, they went in with very little money. They used other people's money and the assets of the company, all of which is legal. And they got a very lucrative business going. And they should be commended for that. I mean, that's American enterprise. American free enterprise capitalism, right?
It is, Your Honor.
And good for Grand County. And good for the state of Wisconsin, right?
Absolutely.
And so there you got them. It's their ingenuity, their cash, whether it's small amount or not. I mean, I wouldn't have known how to do this. When I was a corporate tax lawyer in my former life, I wouldn't have known how to do this, and I wouldn't have taken the risk. I'm risk averse. They're not. That's why they're entrepreneurs, and that's why I'm sitting here, right? Okay. So, what you got is two individuals, it's their money, it's their intelligence, and they take out this money for themselves. What's the matter with that? What is the matter with that? And you tell me there's a big fiduciary duty to the corporation. That's what we're talking about, not to the shareholders. Not to the creditors, not to the labor unions, to the corporation. And it. I mean, where is the corporation? It doesn't exist except on paper and in the statutes, right?
No, Your Honor. The corporation.
No, I'm not right?
No, Your Honor.
All right.
With all respect, no. The corporation is
still... You're on dangerous territory.
I'll be careful. Your Honor, the corporation is standing before you in the person of Michael Polsky, because pursuant to Chapter 128, the corporation lives. And it lives in the person of Michael Polsky, who has the capacity to bring the claims and has brought those claims. And in terms of whether what they did was creative business operating or whether it was just plain wrong, a jury has spoken on that. And after a week of testimony, the jury heard all of the defenses that these very creative defense lawyers could come up with as to why it was okay to take all of that money.
Yeah, but your claim is this is Wall Street on Main Street. That's the claim you're making.
It absolutely is, Your Honor, and those businesses in Grant County, which should and were appreciative of the fact that CPC was there, were left with $600,000 in unsecured debt. That's what they left that corporation with. That's what they left that county with, and they walked away from it. And the receiver has the statutory right, the statutory obligation, to take steps to recover those ill-gotten gains.
Well, I want to talk about the corporation as an entity. It's really a fiction. It's a fiction of the statutes, fiction of our whole business enterprises. But it's a real fiction, right? I mean, it's there.
It's there.
And so I went to look at the dissolution. It reads just like the probate statute. Man, you got the corporation. It wants to go out of business. It has to show all of its claims. It has to give notice to all of its creditors. Creditors can come in and ask for things, including probably going back and getting assets that the corporation no longer has. It's like when you probate somebody's estate. Person dies. You can go back and collect assets from children and grandparents and whatever, so that the creditors and other people that have an interest in that individual are covered. And that's what the dissolution says. So statute provides for dissolution. Statute provides to protect all of the stakeholders, because this corporation is like a person. That person dies, this corporation dies, you've got to handle it all. Receiver is just while that person or entity is still living. Is that right?
I believe that is correct. I think it's a
very... Glad you're agreeing with me at last.
Thank you, Your Honor. Me too. It's a very apt analogy, because when the corporation is dead, by the permission of the legislature, there is, as the court properly points out, a very tightly prescribed way by which the creditors are dealt with. And what we are talking about is not the death of the corporation. We are talking about Chapter 128, not Chapter 180, in terms of the power of a court-appointed entity to reconcile these obligations.
So run the entity. It's like running an individual when they can't do it. I have let you, both of you, proceed longer than red light because I'm stalling you, because in a few seconds the alarm is going to go off. And rather than interrupt your argument, counsel, I'm going to just say we're going to stop for the moment, unless someone else has...
Let me just ask a quick question, and if the alarm goes off, then your time's over. But at the time that the receiver was appointed, what were the damages to the corporation? Not to creditors, not to other people. What were the damages to the corporation?
The damages to the corporation were, the jury later concluded, $6.5 million.
I don't mean that.
But they existed at the time that the corporation went into receivership.
That is $6.5 million in damages?
Correct.
I thought they were a $100,000 loan that they didn't pay back, which was the impetus behind appointing the receiver.
If the damages were measured by the amount owed to creditors, that is to say, if Beloit Liquidating Trust did not exist and the creditors were bringing the claims, damages would be measured by what the creditors lost. But the damages are not measured under fiduciary duty claim by what the creditors lost. They are measured by what amounts these directors took out of the company that they did not deserve.
What the corporation's assets were decreased by.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
Perfect.
you only have another 20 minutes to go, so it should be fine.
If the marshal would report that the alarms here were not as loud as usual, and that the blue lights only came out in one area, not others, and would you check with the people in the chambers to see if they were able to hear all of this? It is very important that everybody in the building can be alerted and clear the building if there is an event. So that was really a rather pleasant experience compared to most of the experiences of this alarm system. So, Counselor, you're done.
Thanks for your kind attention.
Thank you. Let's see, we are going to hear from Mr. Knight, representing the Amicus Curiae Wisconsin Bankers Association.
Morning, Honorable Justices. My name is John Knight with Borden & Loughlin in Madison, representing the Wisconsin Bankers Association as amicus in this case. And our interest in this case arises because of the position taken by defendants, by the officers and directors, that they do not owe a fiduciary duty to the corporation, that they as shareholders and they as the corporation are one, not separate. We find that startling, and to agree with the Chief Justice, radical. Also, the position they've taken that even with the duty, the shareholders have consented, and therefore these officers and directors are immunized from the wrongful acts. We also find that unacceptable and inconsistent with Wisconsin law, and not even a part of our law here. The shareholders and the officers and the directors were all the same individuals, and to think that the left hand can immunize the right hand is quite surprising.
Mr. Knight,
yes.
Do you think that Beloit liquidating applies in this case?
I'm sorry, Chief Justice.
Does Beloit liquidating apply in this case?
Beloit does not apply.
Why?
This is not a Beloit case. This is not brought by a creditor. This is brought by the corporate entity through its receiver. It just isn't Beloit in any respect. And it's about getting a corporate asset back to the corporate entity. And that corporate asset is the claim it makes against its officers and directors for their breach of duty. And what happens to that corporate asset from that point forward is up to the receivership, the court, and they'll make their statutory allocations as they are required to do. So we aren't seeking a change in Beloit and simply think it inapplicable here.
Counsel, you started your comments today with the word radical, and when the chief mentioned it, it made me think of your brief, because that's maybe where she got it. You indicated in your brief.
I'm an independent thinker.
Okay, well. I just read his brief and give it back to him. You indicate that the defendant's position, Brinich and Moore's, would be a radical departure from the common law and would have far-reaching adverse implications for the costs of corporations and third parties doing business in this state. Reading page 10 from your very, very top paragraph, what are those implications, adverse implications for the costs of corporation and third parties doing business in this state?
Well, with respect to banks, whom I represent, we deal with corporate entities. We assume the viability, legal existence of the corporate entity. The officers and the directors come and go. And we assume that certain duties are applicable, certain checks and balances are in place, and certain disincentives to wrongful behavior apply. As lenders, we cannot monitor that daily, shouldn't be, and certain laws would suggest we really ought not to be doing that. So those are assumptions we make. And when those assumptions are no longer valid, it causes us great concern. Now, the banks, to take them as an example, I'm they'll find a way to deal with this. If this court were to decide there is no fiduciary duty and they can immunize themselves by, in their capacity as shareholders, approving what they did as officers and directors, we'll find a way to live with that.
What would you do, personal liability, personal guarantees?
Personal liability, personal guarantees, regular audits, periodic examinations, stricter underwriting.
Pass the cost on.
And passing the cost on. I mean, the cost will go up. It's inevitable. The more the lenders have to do as that constituent of corporations, the cost gets passed on. It makes it more difficult for corporations, more costly for corporations. But those are the kinds of things that will take place. I mean, the lenders will figure out a way to get it accomplished, but it has consequences.
Maybe that's good. Maybe the banks should be more careful.
Well, if the banks are more careful, it's more costly. It's better if there are assumptions that are valid, there are laws that are in place that encourage the right behavior, discourage the wrong behavior. And that's better for all of us. It lowers the cost for all of us, and it makes commercial life much more feasible for all of us. So to put the responsibility to say, all right, there are no duties, and they can absolve themselves of liabilities, let's put the responsibility on the banks or the creditors. I'm not sure that's rightfully placed there or the proper place for it.
Well, to the extent you immunize the individuals, then what you're saying is you can't use the corporate entity to immunize because the banks will get you at the other end or creditors will get you at the other end by requiring personal liability.
For sure. I mean, they are...
Not only you, but maybe other kinds of creditors.
Correct. I mean, they're relying on the limited liability of shareholders because of the corporate vehicle. And if
necessary... Which has been a good vehicle in the United States.
Right. Absolutely right.
Mr. Knight, thank you.
Great. And I knew that it would be. Thank you very much.
Mr. Schott.
Thank you. A couple of brief points that I'd like to make. I think one measure of how sensible a doctrine is what are the results of that doctrine. We have an agreement here now after the discussion that the debts of the corporation are about $1.6 million, about $1 million owed to the bank, debt, including the money it spent in pursuing this litigation, and about $600,000 to the unsecured creditors. We have a verdict here of $6.5 million. You look at Chapter 128, what happens to that money is that the creditors are paid, first the secured creditors, which would be the bank, then the unsecured creditors, and then the remaining money goes to who? The shareholders of CPC. Most of this money will go back to Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores. Is that a sensible result? It seems to me the answer to that is no. And why is this not a sensible result? Because of the application of the receiver's theory.
Except in another situation, you might have had new shareholders. You might have had a sale of the shareholders, and you'd still go back against the old shareholders. So it just so happens that's true here. Seems to me you should have made a deal then. You're going to get all this money back. You spent a lot of money fighting.
Well, they probably could... You know, in retrospect, paying off the $100,000 to the bank in June of 2003 would have been a lot better business proposition for my clients. They asked for something in the negotiations, and instead of continuing the negotiations, the bank went in and...
They wanted to do was be free from personal liability, and that's one of the whole issues in this case. That's the whole point about a corporation.
But the perverse result here is if they hadn't used the corporate structure, if they had... own this corporation in their individual capacities, all they would have been liable for is what was owed to the creditors. They wouldn't be liable for $6.5 million. They would be liable for whatever was owed to the bank and whatever was owed to the other creditors, which we now understand to be $1.6 million. So the application of these doctrines using the corporate structure, which is intended to shield liability, has created four times the liability for my clients under the receiver's theory.
Well, how much are they going to get back out of that $6.5 million?
I think there's a dispute about that because it's my understanding the receiver entered into a contingent fee arrangement with his attorney that's bringing this case, and so there will be, I think, a question about how that contingency fee would work to the extent there are monies that are being collected.
Litigation galore.
Pardon?
Litigation galore here.
Mr. Schott,
should have paid the $100,000.
Mr. Schott, if I remember the duties and responsibilities of a receiver, among other things, the receiver pays off administrative costs, pays off any taxes that might be due, pays off wages. Now, I heard some argument that bonuses were not paid to the employees as required by the collective bargaining agreement, pays off creditors, pays off any taxes that might be due and owing. So I'm not so sure that you can zero in on that $1.6 million and say that's the ballgame.
That $1.6 million, all those people are in the category of the unsecured creditors, so that $1.6 million does include all of those things. And the bonuses that weren't paid to the union was as a result of dispute between the corporation and the union as to what was owed, not as a result of Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moore saying, we don't have the money to pay you. It was, we don't think we owe you these bonuses. The union thought they did, and that was a type of dispute that happens in business transactions all the time.
Counsel?
So you think the $1.6 million includes all of the responsibilities that the receiver would have to pay off?
Yes.
Counsel, I'm mindful you have to address punitive damages. I want to just take a moment for an administrative detail. The Court of Appeals set out the several remaining issues in a footnote. You did not brief some of those issues in this court. Does that mean you're abandoning those issues?
No, it does not.
Well, what does it mean then if you haven't briefed or argued it?
I believe that the court's order accepting certification addressed that issue, and I don't have that order in front of me.
Wasn't it the standard order that says all issues are before this court? My recollection is a standard order. Standard order says we are now the Court of Appeals. You bring all your issues here. You're not limited to certified issues.
I want to briefly address the... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
I'm not cut off. Go ahead, counsel.
Justice Crooks asked the question about when was the information that's on Exhibit 73 available. This information is all taken from the financial statements of CPC, which were given to the bank on a regular basis. So Mr. Cachetta is right that it was not available to the receiver until the receiver was appointed, because there was no receiver until the receiver was appointed. But it was available to the bank. The financial statements were given to the bank as one of the contractual arrangements that the bank made with CPC as part of its loan. We want annual audited financial statements from you, and that's what was provided. I think, to me, the most telling, and this begins to get into the argument on punitive damages, the most telling statistic or number on Exhibit 73 is the column CPC Net Income After Tax, which indicates that during this period of time, 1990 to 2003, after taxes, after all the payments to Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores, a net total income of CPC of $1.4 million. This is after the, in the receiver's view, $10.5 million that were paid to Mr. Vernick and Mr. Moores. The corporation had cumulative net income $1.4 million. Justice Prosser, in terms of your question on punitive damages, this is what Mr. Vernick did for CPC over a 15-year period of time, created a net profit of $1.4 million. To me, that's an argument against the assessment of punitive damages. I see my red light.
Next column, mean consolidated income after tax, which shows a $754,000 loss.
This was the receiver's exhibit put together by the receiver's expert, but my understanding of that is her attempt to look at CPC not as an independent legal entity, but as a consolidated entity and taking into account BASIC and CPRO.
You said that the bank had all the information from 73, Exhibit 73, but not in this form.
Correct. It had the audited financial statements.
Of which company?
CPC.
Not Basic Products, right?
Correct.
Not, what's the other company, CPRO?
CPRO. But the audited financial statements of Communication Products Corporation showed the equipment leases, showed the salaries, showed the management fee, showed the payments.
Thank you very much.
Members of the court.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank Mr. Schott, Mr. Kishida, for their excellent briefs and their excellent arguments on a very difficult case that goes to some of the very basic concepts of corporate law and puts them in a very different framework. So we really do appreciate that, and we appreciate your answers to our questions, which are attempting to understand the intricacies of these dealings. With that, I will conclude our hearing on 07AP203, Michael S. Polsky versus Daniel Vernich et al. And the court will take a few minutes of recess, so these students may leave if they wish, and other students may come back. Thank you. We are